We just played a clip from our interview with Jonathan Eig, who wrote King, A Life, the story of Martin Luther King. He just won the Pulitzer Prize. I was kind of curious about the prize. If you get one of the Pulitzer Prizes, you get a gold medal. Everybody else gets cash, $15,000. I thought it was going to be more than that. I know the Nobel is pretty generous that way. Invest wisely, kids. The Nobel Prize pays over $1 million cash. Hey, John Williams, our country's history is just troubling. I can't believe that even happened, says Brian, age 54. 773 says the rhetoric hasn't changed, just the people discriminated against. And 773 says everyone should go to the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. I was 8 years old when this was happening, and I don't consider myself old. Speaking of parks, we told the story about how Oak Park in Montgomery, Alabama, was segregated when the law determined that they couldn't do that rather than integrate it. They just shut this beautiful park down. We are reminded that Millennium Park in Chicago is open to everybody, but wait. In 2022, Mayor Lori Lightfoot implemented the youth escort policy. Banning minors who are not accompanied by an adult from going to Millennium Park after 6 p.m. Thursday through Sunday, when groups of kids were wilding or intimidating people on weekend nights at Millennium Park in the summer. She said, okay, you got to be with an adult to get in. They put guards up at the various entrance points. Lightfoot made the move after 16-year-old Sendal Holiday was killed near the Bean sculpture. The curfew is still in place, entering its third year. It extends to Maggie Daly Park as well, which is connected to Millennium Park through that cool pedestrian bridge. The curfew is slated to begin at Maggie Daly Park on May 20th, according to the park's website. Pete, I presume then at Millennium Park as well, May 20th, if you are under the age of 16, is that the age I just read here? Then you will need to be accompanied by an adult or a guardian if you go into Millennium Park after 6 p.m. After 6. 11:38. On Tuesdays at this time, we visit with Eric Zorn, the one-time publisher of the Chicago Tribune. I'm fumbling all over my words, Eric. Columnist at the Chicago Tribune, the publisher now of the Picayune Sentinel. Hi, Mr. Zorn. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, you know, your listener who was 8 years old when Martin Luther King was assassinated says they don't feel old. They're old. I was 10 when that happened, and I'm old, so I have to disagree with that. I just finished John Eig's book yesterday.
Oh, my gosh.
Just hours before the announcement came of the Pulitzer Prize. Have you read the whole thing?
Yeah. I have it in front of me. I brought it in today. I've got all my notes and highlights here.
It's a doorstop of a book. I mean, it's really long. It becomes a page-turner. I thought it started a little slow. Kind of starts off into the deep history of the King family, and I was like, okay, let's get going here, but it really accelerates, and the stories that it tells from events that happened in our country, in our lifetime, are just so appalling, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, you think, yeah, we still have problems with racial justice in this country. All these problems still exist, but boy, the open racism and hostility with which King was greeted around the country, and particularly in Chicago, are really amazing to think about where we were at that time and what was accepted in our society. And it's a really, really good book, and I'm really glad he wrote it. And it was a really good thing that he got that prize.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, Chicago, and just picking the big characters in American history. And you think that we don't need another Martin Luther King book. This is definitive. It's 700 pages, and it's one amazing little anecdote after another. It has a very intimate feel.
Right, and it does glorify King in a way, but it shows you who he really was, depression that he suffered, the problems that he had, and also the fact that I think we have forgotten about totally, which is that he was not a particularly popular figure when he was alive, that his poll numbers dropped and dropped and dropped as he was continuing to make noise on the protest scene. And it wasn't just because of his civil rights work. It was because of his strong opposition to the Vietnam War. which really set him back in public opinion polls. So it's easy to think of him now as he's just a sainted figure and everything. But he was a real man with real problems and real failings, and was really unpopular for a while. And it's a really interesting book. You know, you say the world didn't need another biography of King, but as I just pointed out, there hadn't been one for like 35 years. That historians have just said, well, that's over.
Yeah.
And he came up with tons of material and interviewed a whole bunch of people who are, you know, in the last days of their lives. Some of them he interviewed are now gone. Plus the FBI files that were opened up for him.
He said that was one of the things, yeah, that motivated him. And you're right. He said, I had to run around and interview all those people before they passed, before those stories died with them. And I also admire how he resisted the temptation to moralize. He told you that he was a philanderer, that he had affairs. He told you that some of the work that he presented as his own was not his own. And was that because he was unethical or because he was just not good about crediting other people? He doesn't really decide for you. He just straight up tells you these things. And you do come away with the picture of a human being, not some Mount Rushmore type saint.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me a little bit of what Lin-Manuel Miranda did for Hamilton and the founding father and the founders, which is, you know, he humanized them. He pointed out that these were actual people who had actual conflicts and actual failings, and we can't pretend that they were deified in their day or that they deserve deification today. Martin Luther King was a great man, and his devotion to nonviolence, which did not make him a popular figure among a lot of black revolutionaries, was really singular. I thought it's a great book. I hope that like high schools will assign it, and it'll be a book that it's such a great modern history of that whole era in American life and it's long. I know it's, you know, kids will hate having to look at it, 700 pages, something like that.
Yeah.
It's worth it. It's really worth it.
Well, it's funny because Ike says his kids didn't want him to write it. They go, no, don't do that. That's history. That's not an event. We're not interested in that story, Dad. Well, I'll bet they're interested in it now. One other thing. I asked my audience, Eric, a moment ago to text in those blind spots you have, cultural blind spots on Wheel of Fortune yesterday or the day before. The contestants, the celebrity contestants, did not know who Jason and Travis Kelce were. And even as all of those letters but one were spelled out before them, they did not know Jason and Travis Elsie. They didn't know what the next letter was until one of them guessed K, and then they said Jason and Travis Kelce. They still didn't know who they were. So I said, you know, I think a lot of us every now and then are amazed at how there's something everybody knew about that we didn't. Or you turn to your kids and say, wait, you don't know who Ed Sullivan was? That was a big deal. And so I asked them to tell us what some of those were. Hey, John Williams, I would not have known that puzzle answer either. Okay. John, I work with people in their 20s who don't know who Robin Williams is. John, no one under 30 knows who Fonzie is. I'm not sure you have to know who Fonzie is, but I'll bet they know who Henry Winkler is. John, people in their 20s don't know greats like George Carlin, Richard Pryor. They don't know Johnny Carson. It's a sad state of affairs. I don't get it, John. I was born in 1980, and I still know who the Beatles were. Says one of our listeners. You were about to say something, Eric Zorn?
Well, I mean, Johnny Carson retired, what, was it 30 years ago? I think it was 30 years ago that he left the air. And so people who are under 40 would have very little exposure to Johnny Carson. He's like Jack Parr might be to you and me. It's someone who's like, oh yeah, I've heard about him, but I can't really tell you anything about him.
Right. Okay. But I mean, but Johnny Carson left a big enough thumbprint on America or footprint that you'd think you would, just as a participant in society, have heard about him. But I'll even forgive you if you don't know who the Fonzie was. I'll kind of forgive you for that. Sometimes, though, they don't know who important political figures are or historical things are.
Well, is there a difference between this sort of historical knowledge, like who are the Andrews sisters or something like that? I mean, this is just like trivia. Or is it something, I mean, Travis Kelce is someone who is a current figure in the news. He's just not in the news that you're aware of. And I have a lot of gaps like that with pop culture, pop music. People will make references to a Game of Thrones characters, and I'll just like, I haven't watched that yet.
I have a million of these things too, but and I don't want to therefore judge people for their lack of cultural or historic knowledge, because it's difficult to keep up. But some things you do need to know about, and then some you give them a pass. My sister just told me that her daughter, my niece, doesn't know who Farrah Fawcett is. I find that amazing. But only because Farrah Fawcett was a central figure in my life. She was a pop icon when I was a teenager, so that was a big deal.
On the poster on the wall.
Oh my gosh! Get her the poster. Eric Zorn joins us, the Picayune Sentinel publisher. It's a weekly newsletter you can subscribe to for free if you email ericzorn@gmail.com. I've been talking this week, Eric, to a professor who's been advising the students at the University of Chicago about how to conduct the negotiations and the protests. What's your take on either the U of C, DePaul, Northwestern, or just the whole campus culture right now?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what to make of these protests. I don't know what their long-term goal is, and this is something that's been puzzling me as I've been reading the stories and listening to interviews and seeing the video footage from these protests. I get that they want their campuses to divest from businesses that either are part of the war machine in Israel or just anything to do with Israel. It's unclear to me exactly what the goal is there. That's the short-term goal, but what is the long-term goal of these protesters? And I hear them talking about, like, from the river to the sea and free Palestine. Does that mean that they want the Jews to just leave Israel and pretend it's 1947 again and go back to wherever their families came from? And at that time, I'm not sure what that means. Or is it a desire for a two-state solution, which is something that I think has to happen, even though people say that it's unlikely right now. But two-state solution means Israel has a right to exist, that the Palestinian people need a homeland. They can work that out. Now, that's a very elusive goal. That's something that I think I can get behind. I can certainly get behind the idea of stopping this carnage that's going on, stopping all the innocent people who are being killed. I would like that to happen. But I don't know what if these protesters are saying they want Israel basically wiped off the map. I can't get behind that. And I don't know that even that desire is anti-Semitic, as the anti-Zionist position is not necessarily anti-Semitic. But I just don't know. I don't know where I stand on this, because I don't know where the protesters stand. I don't know what their message is exactly. Do you?
Well, it depends on the campus and who you talk to, but it's divest of any holdings in Israel. In the case of the University of Chicago, they wanted to disband the police, which is ridiculous, though, on the south side. They also wanted the end of gentrification, because they saw a parallel between, say, pushing people outside of homes that they can no longer afford on the south side to what's happened to the people in Gaza. I get it, but that's a reach. And when I asked the professor who's been advising them what they hope to accomplish, or do they think they played their cards well, did they get anything done here because the camp is gone? She said that, you know, the arc of justice is a long one and that the movement is slow. And so while they don't know exactly what they accomplished, she did say they know we're here and we're angry and we think they'll be more responsive to demands from the students in the future. I don't know what I just said, but it's something like that.
I don't either. And that's why I wrote something saying, like, I think that we're all behind the idea of peace.
Yep.
Most of us are behind the idea of peace. We would like innocent people to stop being killed, and we'd like these perpetually warring factions in the Middle East to figure out a way to live together without killing each other. That seems like a goal that we can all get behind. The rest of it, I'm not sure of. And so I was thinking, like, oh, I'm in sympathy with these protesters. And then I hear some of the things that they're chanting, and I wonder what they mean to them.
You and I have had this argument, though, for 3 weeks now, Eric, or as long as this has been going on. Do you think that the anti-Semitic chants represent the movement overall?
I didn't think so, but I'm not sure anymore. As I look at the coverage, as I read the things, as I, you know, you talk about what this professor is telling you down at University of Chicago, is she Does she want the Jews to leave leave Israel, to leave their home, to leave their homeland now? Is that what she wants? Is that what the students want?
I don't know.
And that's why I don't know. It's a situation where I would really like to open some dialogue with some of these people. But you see in a lot of these, in some of these footage, that the students really don't want to talk to the media. The reporters will approach them, and they don't want to sit down and talk. And I'm not sure that they understand, because I don't understand fully by any means the incredibly complicated history of that region, which has been home to lots of different peoples over the years, and the various accords that have been come to and then broken or violated in some way over the years. It's not a really simple situation at all. If it were, it would have been solved a long time
ago. Sure, but I'll bet when this story gets told years from now and they say, what was the protest on college campuses in 2024 about? The answer will be, in 2024, the students on the campuses wanted the war in Gaza to end. That's what it's about. They want the war to end.
Right.
And then there's a million tentacles to that, but that's the thrust of this thing.
Right, and of course, people were saying that about the 1968 protests, too.
But they were right about that, too. I mean, and I don't even care if they're right or not, but I mean, if you had to boil it down to something, I think their cause is just. I don't think that the radical elements should define what overall is end the carnage.
I agree that the cause is just of stopping that war over there. The cause was just of stopping the war in Vietnam. I wonder, though, historically, if all that protest, all that tumult in the streets of Chicago and everywhere else about the Vietnam War prolonged that war by electing Richard Nixon. That's what I worry about here too. Yeah. I see this song by Macklemore, which is I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden in the fall. Like, are you still going to vote for Donald Trump? I mean, Macklemore was part of the F Donald Trump song a few years ago. I mean, he doesn't like Donald Trump, so that's the choice. You got a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump this fall. And if these protesters think that they're going to be better off, the Palestinian people are going to be better off with Donald Trump in the White House, that's crazy.
Yeah, but there's only one president in office right now. And this came up on our last Mincing Rascals podcast, perhaps the play. And it's not coordinated. This is not a very vertical organization, right? But the play is that you're going to force this administration to do right by this war and by Israel, by the divestment, that is. So that's the play. It doesn't have to elect Donald Trump. It has to force the U.S. to do right now. That's what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty sensible tactic to take if you want to get, say, the Biden administration to withhold military support from Israel as long as Israel doesn't agree, say, not to go rampaging through the streets of Rafah. That's a short-term goal that makes some sense. I get that. But long-term, if you think that, okay, we're not going to – I mean, they're urging people right now not to vote for Joe Biden in November – this thing is going to take a lot of turns between now and November, and you're going to have to choose who you want in the White House,
Joe Biden
or Donald Trump. You're not going to get RFK Jr. or anybody else. So anyway.
Yeah, RFK, if you're listening, boy, are you going to be the Jill Stein or the Ralph Nader or the who else maybe tipped an election because of their third-party status?
Ross Perot,
among others. All right, we're out of time today. I'll talk to you on the podcast tomorrow.
Talk to you, John. Thanks.
Eric Zorn writes something called the Picayune Sentinel, and he's part of the Mincing Rascals podcast, broadcast on Saturday nights, and our podcast drops Wednesday afternoons at WGNRadio.com and everywhere.